Welcome everyone to episode 4 of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast, where we speak to interesting and knowledgeable people about how best to protect sentient beings from the harms of coming into existence. I am your host, John, an antinatalist advocate from the UK, and I'll be the main host of the podcast going forward. I'd like to think that we're building a bit of momentum with this podcast. So far, we've introduced ourselves as an organisation. We spoke with Amanda Oldfan-Sukunik about antinatalism as a philosophy and a community. And we also had on Michael, aka Vegan Space Scientist, to give us the rundown on effective altruism, or EA for short. And having laid the groundwork with these early episodes, we're now going after the big guns in the EA community, starting with the father of effective altruism, philosopher Peter Singer. More about him later. This is going to be the first part of a series where we respond to key figures in the EA community on the topic of antinatalism. We believe that the EA community has done a wonderful job of combining the head and the heart by using reason and evidence to make the world a better place. As you'll hear in this episode, we really do admire the EA community, and especially Peter Singer himself. But we believe that in their efforts to do good, the EA community has a serious blind spot, the antinatalist blind spot, because the only guaranteed way of protecting individuals from harm is to not bring them into existence in the first place. That's why we're doing this series, to bring antinatalism to the attention of the EA community. I'll be hosting these episodes with the co-founder of Antinatalist Advocacy, Lawrence Anton. You'll probably know him best from his YouTube channel, where he uploads a wide range of content on antinatalism. And without feeding his ego, I think his videos are pretty damn good. There'll be a link in the description. I'm really grateful to have Lawrence alongside me at Antinatalist Advocacy, and I'm very lucky to be able to call him my friend. Anyway, without further ado, I bring you episode 4 of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast with Lawrence Anton. Enjoy. Welcome everyone to episode 4 of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast, and welcome back, Lawrence. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I don't know if you count as a two-time guest, as you are part of AA, so I'm not going to, you know, celebrate too much the fact that you came on, but I'm still very grateful that you're on today.
Yeah, I mean, as not long, if I can brutalize the English language in that way, but as not long as we have been around, I'm already part of the furniture.
Exactly. So yeah, I think you did give a bit of an intro to yourself when we did the introduction to AA, the very first episode of this podcast, but I thought it would be good if you could introduce yourself more as a well more about your YouTube channel, really, and like your broader role in the antinatalist community, if you'd like to share a few thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, with the channel, I started uploading, I sort of had a false start right at the very beginning. I uploaded a video, which is now no longer on there, but I uploaded a video saying how I'm going to be uploading regularly and then didn't. But I properly started to get it going with regular uploads, I think. I mean, I haven't actually been timekeeping, but it's maybe around like a year and a half ago or something like that, or maybe 2 years ago, I'm not sure. But I guess the main things that I do on there are I have two sort of series on there. So one of them is antinatalism around the world, where I talk to antinatalists in different countries, cultures, because... Well, for a range of reasons, really. I mean, one, I just thought it'd be really interesting to talk to antinatalists from around the world. Second of all, you'll get different insights, because different people from different cultures and different religious, you know, contexts will be able to give you a different perspective on antinatalism, but also how antinatalism interacts with those things. And they'll have different political situations and how all those things interact. And it's been super interesting. But also... there is this sort of idea that some people hold that antinatalism is like a privileged belief, that like only the most privileged people can hold this, which is very much not the case. You know, I've only done, I think, 10 episodes of the series or whatever, and I've already spoken to people in very underprivileged situations in poor countries that, you know, if they were to speak openly about antinatalism, they could be killed, you know. So, put their face to it. They, you know, can speak anonymously online, but you get what I mean. And then apart from that, I have conversations with a range of people on there, and I also just make standalone videos as well that dive into a topic related to antinatalism. So one I did recently was on animals and antinatalism, and I do a whole bunch of other videos as well that are just sort of, you know, random things here and there. Did you want to know how my channel fits into the community?
Good question. I think if you feel that there's like a distinction between the two, it would be good to draw out that distinction. I think by now a lot of people do know you through your YouTube channel within the community, although you have been involved in other things, obviously AA being one of those things.
I mean, to be honest, that's the main distinction. So there's the YouTube channel. I think how that interacts with the community is that I think a lot of people use it as, well, people who are already antinatalist, I think, use it as a way to like somewhat stay up to date with antinatalism, because I, you know, often like I speak to a lot of people and ask them what the current projects are they're working on and stuff like that. And also I think like a person who's only just come across the idea, I think my channel kind of serves as a prepackaged rabbit hole that they can go down. Like you just kind of need to come across one channel and you can just watch video after video on the same topic but slightly different angles and aspects and stuff. And then apart from the channel, it's stuff like AA and other projects that I've worked on. Like another thing that I sort of manage is the Antinatalist Handbook, which is sort of like a passive resource that people can, it's just, you know, it's just there as a website. People can go there and use it whenever they like. I think that's it.
Yeah, and as someone who did use your channel, or I did fall down the Lawrence Anton rabbit hole when I was first interested in AA, and I know I've said this to you separately, and I'm not just saying this as a friend, like your YouTube content is very good. So if you are interested in stuff to look out, do check out Lawrence's channel. I mean, there's just, a bunch of like really serious videos or like heavy topics that are done in an accessible manner. And then there's just joke stuff. Not joke stuff, but kind of a bit more lighthearted stuff.
Yeah,
as well.
Less serious.
And just a range of different formats, like that wonderful series, Antinatalism Around the World. They're kind of like long form interviews, almost like a podcast. And then there are shorts, there are like videos like that, kind of like 10 to 15 minute length too. Yeah. So something on there for everyone. Good honest fun for all the family. But we're here today not to stroke your ego, telling you what such a great YouTuber you are. But we're here today for our own kind of series on AAP, our own kind of podcast series. And that is on responding to the effective altruist community on antinatalism. Now, at the time this video, this podcast has come out, it will have been a month since the introduction to effective altruism episode with Michael, vegan space scientist. So we're not going to rehash our ground and go into too much detail on what effective altruism is as a philosophy and a community. But very quickly, Lawrence, how did you first become interested in EA? As both a philosophy and a community.
That's actually an interesting one. I can't quite remember, but I have a vague sense that it was actually through Humane Hancock. So I mean, no one else is going to know because I'm the one who, you know, I you know, no one else is going to know how I discovered EU because I'm the one who discovered it for myself. But I'm pretty sure it was through Jack's channel. So for anyone who doesn't know, Humane Hancock is a vegan YouTuber, but I'd say, I don't know, a couple of years ago or a few years ago, he started to talk more about wild animal suffering. And as soon as he changed lanes and started to talk about that, I became like very interested in his channel. I didn't really watch it before then, but at the time I had been giving public talks about more system level, like plant-based food system stuff, and the ethical
vegan kind of animal rights talks.
Yeah, exactly. But the reason I don't say vegan is because it wasn't aimed at individual change. It was aimed at, it was communicating information about whole food system change to people. But obviously, if people ask questions about veganism, I answered them. But that just wasn't the specific topic of the talk. But anyway, as part of that talk, I was talking about how, you know, if we switch to a plant-based food system, it will use less land and stuff. And I was advocating as part of that talk for rewilding. And I use, you know, a famous example in Yellowstone National Park about them reintroducing wolves. And Jack came out with a video which was on that exact case study in Yellowstone National Park. And he just completely slapped me around the face with it. Because, you know, I think maybe everyone listening kind of knows the distinction of, like, you know, mainstream sort of environmentalism, conservationism always looks at animals from species level, doesn't really appreciate them for the individuals they are. Yeah. But if you take almost what is a vegan perspective of appreciating individual animals for who they are and recognizing them as the, you know, the true morally relevant factor in all of this, if you look at nature from that point of view, it gives you a very different picture. And I hadn't been looking at it from that point of view, and Jack's videos kind of woke me up to that. And so I started watching his content. He's quite into effective altruism, and so I think I just through his videos kind of became more familiar with it, and then explored it a bit more, and then the thing that really got me, you know, sort of like more involved with it was reading The Life You Can Save by Peter Singer. And once I read that, I set up monthly donations, and which go in my bank account every month and all that sort of stuff.
Fantastic. It sounds like we had a fairly similar introduction
to
EA, as I also found out about it through vegan YouTube. There was a YouTube, there is still a YouTuber called Ask Yourself. I used to watch a lot more vegan YouTube back in the day than I do now. But in one of the videos, Ask Yourself mentioned different charities that would be good to support. And he mentioned the effective altruists as a community that seeks to look at impactful charities and ways of having impact. And this happened to coincide with me, already shortly afterwards, I wrote a dissertation on animal rights for wild animals. So I was looking at again, wild animals as individuals rather than as a species. And you quickly find out, if you look at the experience of individual wild animals, a rosy view of nature where it's all circle of life and everything's in balance and harmony, it really doesn't hold up. I mean, you know, we have a lot of resources on our website, on the antinatalist advocacy website, on wild animal suffering and why it's important. And one of the few communities that was really paying attention to wild animal suffering in 2019 were the effective altruists, partly for their suffering focused, well, a lot of focus on like reducing suffering as a means of doing good. So that's how I personally found out about them. And yeah, they definitely influenced my career decision since then, and also where I donate my money to. So seeing as both of us, our behavior has certainly been influenced by the EA community and kind of like EA, just broader EA ideas in general. What are your general thoughts on EA? Like, it sounds like they would be generally pretty positive.
As a community or as a philosophy or both?
Well, that's the thing, is that I do something that we've talked about before with respect to antinatalist advocacy, is this separation between EA as a philosophy and EA as a community.
Yeah.
And I do think maybe for this podcast and probably for the series going forward, we should try and distinguish when we are talking
about which one
we're talking about. I think for this series, we're going to be very much responding to things people within the EA community have said about antinatalism. So we'll be talking specifically about community. But in terms of your general opinions, Lawrence, we'll start with the philosophy and then the community that kind of like sprung up around it.
I think as far as the philosophy goes, I think the basic message is a very good one.
Yeah.
You know, it's basically, it's recognizing the fact that a lot of people want to do good in the world, but they don't necessarily put their rational faculties behind doing that. You know, some people may do, and they may just have faulty information, but EA seemed to me to be quite a game changer because it really put reason and evidence behind doing good. So it said, okay, we want to do good in the world. What does that actually look like? Where can we make the most, you know, where can we make the most ground, basically? Because I think if you ask any person on the street, do you think it's a good thing to improve the lives of others and make the world a better place? You know, everyone's going to say yes.
Yeah.
And then if you ask them, well, if you can spend the same amount of time and the same amount of resources putting effort into doing that, would you not want to pursue an avenue which is going to produce greater, to use an investing term, like returns on that, right? I think that basic logic is very, you know, appealing to people, and it makes a lot of sense. It's just, it didn't occur to a lot of people until EA came around. They really, you know, they wouldn't have come up with this idea. Like, you know, people would have, maybe individual people or small groups of people would have had this idea before, but EA really popularized it, turned it into a sort of coherent philosophy with the community sort of acting on it. So the general principles of EA, I think, are good. The concerns that I have about the philosophy, and some of this may bleed into the community as well, because sometimes they are somewhat hard to tease apart. But the thing that I think is pure philosophy that I do have somewhat of an issue with is that whilst I think it is good to base a lot of your charitable giving or however you want to do good on you know, measurable, impact focused advocacy or work, that I think there is room for more speculative efforts in doing good. So there are, and you know, this is a common criticism of EA as well, is that it's just too measurement driven. There are some forms of doing good that you can't measure or are very difficult to measure, and we haven't come up with good ways of measuring them. You know, like, everyone listening to this now can think of a specific moment in political or social history that just happened kind of out of nowhere, but led to massive change. You know, it became a symbol of something and it drove change, or, you know, something like that. Or, you know, like chaos theory, it kind of, you know, the butterfly beats their wings and it ends up leading to something a lot bigger, which maybe was never intended, but it still had a very positive outcome. And all of these sorts of things can't be measured. And I think maybe adhering to the philosophy too much can neglect those things, and then overall may actually lead to, you know, a less amount of good being done. Stuff that then kind of bleeds into the community is that, but still strongly linked with the philosophy, is that there does seem to be a strong, how would you put it, like, adherence to certain views of population ethics.
Yes.
or certain normative ethics in EA. Now, I think, you know, technically, you know, EA as a community always says, or as a philosophy says, that, you know, anyone with any sort of ethical point of view can come to EA because it's sort of theory neutral kind of thing. In the real world, you know, and this does bleed into the community side of things, but in the real world, it does tend to be quite utilitarian. And it does also tend to be quite, I'm not sure what the sort of correct terminology for this is, but there's a thing called Narveson's dictum, which is basically, should we be making people happy, or should we be making happy people? And a lot of, you know, a lot of people who would maybe be more have a more pessimistic philosophy or antinatalists would focus more on making people happy rather than making happy people, because, you know, within the context of antinatalism, it doesn't make sense to make happy people, but it perfectly makes sense to make people happy. And I think there seems to be a strong bias in EA towards seeing making happy people as a good thing.
Yes.
And this is maybe most noticeably expressed in the adherence to sort of optimistic long-termism.
Yeah.
I've talked for quite a while. So yeah, those are my like initial thoughts.
Definitely. And I think they reflect a lot of my thoughts as well when it comes to EA as a philosophy and a community. We will definitely be doing an episode at some point on long-termism and a deep dive on what that is. But I do agree. I think the general idea behind EA of trying to do the most good possible, to be as efficient as possible, or as you put it, it's almost like get the best return on your investment, I think is absolutely the right approach when it comes to doing good. When it comes to spending money on our own lives, if you could buy two laptops that cost the same amount of money and one of them was 100 times better than the other, you wouldn't even consider supporting or purchasing the laptop that was 100 times less good than the one that you could be buying. And that is the way that it is with a lot of charities. Like, based upon the data, based upon our best understanding of the data, there are charities within the same field that are 100 or even 1,000 times more effective at pursuing the aim that you want to pursue. So, for example, if you want to save human lives, treating malaria seems to be one of the most cost-effective things that you can do. That's hanging up insecticide-ridden bed nets, or, as there have been big breakthroughs last year, investing in things like a vaccine. Putting money towards things like a vaccine.
Yeah.
And an organization like Malaria Consortium has done a lot of work on that. And this is just a much cheaper means of saving human lives than other things like cancer research or other things that have had a lot more money put, a lot of causes that have had a lot more money put towards them. So EA is really good at like highlighting those neglected causes, highlighting areas where you can have that impact and supporting people to have a big impact. Totally agree, though, that there are things that are hard to measure, especially social change or systemic change. I do think that EA is less bullish on this point than they were before. I think they are a lot more humble. Not that they were ever not humble, but certainly in their messaging, they are open to the fact that they don't have all the answers, and that things like systemic change are really difficult to measure. As someone who works in impact evaluation, there are just lots of things often in terms of doing good or in terms of positive social change that are much more difficult to measure. That said, I do think that EA still have the right approach by trying to be data-driven. But yes, unfortunately in the community, I say unfortunately like it's a, certainly from minorities' perspective as antinatalists, there do seem to be a lot of ideas around it being a truly good thing. And in fact, a moral imperative, something that we should do to try and create more sentient beings, which Lawrence and I as antinatalists are quite firmly against. So this is why we thought that this would be a good series for us to do as people who really do admire aspects of the EA community, and certainly core tenets of the philosophy is people who, again, we've both taken the giving what we can pledge, which is where you commit to giving at least 10% of your income to what the evidence suggests are the most effective charities. As people who have taken that pledge, as people who really do admire a lot of what goes on in the EA community. I think this series, where we're almost being, I think the term we use at work is critical friends. So we're not trying to be hostile. We're not trying to straw man or belittle the EA community. But we are just trying to say that there is another way of approaching this topic of population ethics and antinatalism in particular. And the best way that we thought of doing that is by responding to what EA figures have said about antinatalism. And so we're going to start with, in many ways, the grandfather of EA, or at least the philosopher whose ideas inspired EA, and that is probably the most famous philosopher in the world, Peter Singer. Before we respond to his comments on antinatalism, Lawrence, what are your general thoughts on Peter Singer, his career, his work? If you have any thoughts of him as a person, obviously neither of us know him personally.
Yeah.
But what are your general thoughts about Peter Singer?
To be honest, my general thoughts on Peter Singer is that I value a lot of the work he's done, but he really annoys me sometimes. That's sort of like my elevator sort of pitch answer type answer.
I don't mean to be a psychologist here, but does he annoy you because you admire him so much that
it's almost like
when he says something or takes a position that you disagree with, it's like, oh, Peter Singer, like it wounds you in a way that if someone you didn't care about or didn't respect.
I think he annoys me for two reasons. So the first reason is that he has a platform and he's taken seriously by ethically minded people, and his opinions are going to have influence in the places that matter. And I think he believes certain things or publicly states certain things that I think are going to spread harmful beliefs, basically. So if I give an example about this, one of the things is that he wrote Animal Liberation. He goes around talking about the moral consideration of animals all the time. You know, we went and saw him on a tour that he was doing that at.
He's often called like the father of the animal liberation movement.
Exactly.
Like,
his
book is really just like a seminal piece in
the very influential
liberation movement.
But at the same time, he is not vegan, which he makes utilitarian based arguments for that. And whatever you think of the arguments in and of themselves, I think, and we can just ignore those for a bit now, but the fact that he is, as he describes it, you know, like 95 to 99% vegan in terms of diet, he doesn't go that extra like 1 or 2% or 5% to just be fully vegan all the time in a principled way. Because I know obviously to a utilitarian, the term principle may not mean that much, right? Because it's
not principle. Yes.
Yeah.
Because they're not rules based moral theories. It's not like a hard rule that says
exactly,
you can never eat animal products.
Yeah. But the reason that annoys me is, even if you ignore whether his specific arguments for that make sense, I think he doesn't appreciate the fact that we live in a world where most people really don't understand ethics in a sophisticated way. Like, people need neat and tidy rules to follow. And they for example, with veganism, we need to get to a point where people just understand eating animals bad, right? Yeah. Like, in the long term, that's going to be the good meme that we can spread on this topic.
Yeah.
Even if someone can make a utilitarian argument that in certain circumstances, there's maybe no moral issue with it. Like, to me, that's sort of a nitpicky point you make in a seminar on a university somewhere, but it's not something you spread on a public platform, because I think it's going to give the people that want to find a way to pay for animals to be killed in farms and exploited, it's going to give them that clause, right?
Mm.
And we live in a world where most people are looking for that clause desperately. So that I find really, I think it's just very irresponsible for him to, you know, to talk about that in public, just, you know, irregardless of whether his arguments hold or not. I just don't think it's a good PR.
I definitely agree with that. And I think that, again, the vegan thing is a really simple message. So often a lot of vegans will experience people asking them about like vegan gray areas. So for example, should you as a vegan drink almond milk, given that many bees are killed in the industrial almond milk industry? And I personally don't drink almond milk for that reason. However, I don't go around telling people not to drink almond milk because I don't want to complicate the simple meme, as you're talking about, Lawrence, of don't eat animals or anything that comes from them. And I have I don't even have a following, to be honest. Certainly not compared to Peter Singer.
Yeah.
So I do think that Peter Singer, and especially from someone who is utilitarian, I can see why on an individual basis, that rule of don't be vegan, like never consume an animal product, that you could find exceptions to that. But especially given his platform, he does seem to be undercutting that very simple meme. And there's a very good resource by Magnus Vinding called Why Vegan, which I'll definitely link in the comments or the description of this episode, where he talks about the positive benefits of having that rule. And one of them is that you have a moral rule that you abide by, that I am vegan. And that gives yourself motivation to stay vegan. And it gives people something to look at and a clear thing for them to understand the stance that you're taking. Whereas Peter Singer's is a bit murkier. And as you said, it can be a bit confusing and giving people an easier out. So that is that is something that I do disagree with him. Or I agree with you on and strongly disagree with the things that you said. Like, I do think that even from his own perspective as a utilitarian, he would be having more of a positive impact if he just said, I'm vegan, and then that was it.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, those are my general thoughts is that, he annoys me because of, you know, so he just seems so close to being such a solid character that we can, you know, rely on, but he just kind of lets down the team, as it were, in some ways. But I really appreciate overall, I really appreciate the work that he's done and the conversations he's generated, you know, for all his faults, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think my general feelings about Peter Singer are extremely positive, even though I think in his comments on antinatalism, his kind of soft promotion of long-termism, which is something that we'll talk about when we get to Will McCaskill. He may actually have a very negative impact on the world because of our differences in population ethics. I think, you know, Peter Singer is one of those, there's a criticism of philosophy, which I think does hold up. And that is that a lot of it is quite pretentious. It's from an ivory tower. It's not applied in the real world. And the people don't practice what they preach. Peter Singer is just one of those people who's like, no, we need to get these ethics out of the seminar room, put them into simple language and get them out into the world, whether that's going vegan, not eating animals, whether it's giving money to charity. He puts it into practical, simple terms. It's not just this is the right thing to do and not doing anything about it. He has always strived from the beginning of his career to use philosophy to try and make the world a better place. And for me, that is his personal legacy and something that I truly admire him on, even though, as we'll come to, we do have some pretty big disagreements on things which are very important to me. I just admire him for that. And in a world where a lot of people, you know, a lot of people virtue signal, a lot of people tell themselves, I am a good person, and their actions don't necessarily align with that. Peter Singer is one of those people who he walks the walk. He talks the talk, and he has done throughout his career, and he really walks the walk and tries to support other people to walk the walk as well. And that's why I admire him so much. And something you were mentioning earlier, which is why we will finally, after half an hour in, we will finally get around to responding to Peter Singer. So Lawrence and I and a few other friends, we went to go and see Peter Singer talk a couple of months ago. And we got on the topic of animal liberation and veganism. And we got to ask him a couple of questions, which were obviously on the theme of animals and animal liberation, but had an antinatalist bent to them, which Peter Singer very quickly picked up on in his answers to those questions. So for the remainder of this episode, we're going to respond to Peter Singer's, well, Peter Singer's responses to our questions on antinatalism. So the first clip we're going to play is your question, Lawrence, which is on a population ethics and about whether it would be okay to bring lives into existence even if they're going to have a premature death. So we're going to roll the audio now.
My question was inspired by a recent interview / conversation you did, Peter, on the Sentientism podcast with Jamie. And near the end of your conversation, you talk about a case of free-range chickens coming into existence and how if we bring them into existence and they have, you know, really, you know, nice lives by their standards, not by some sort of bureaucrat standard somewhere, but with the condition that at some point we will kill them, you know, before they would naturally die. You said that this case, you know, you haven't come to a sort of conclusion on yet as to whether you think it would be good to create this chicken or not. And I thought I would ask the question, given that there's, you know, there's no chicken to want to come into existence, what do you think the case would be for bringing them into existence, given there's no one to want it in the first place?
Yeah, well, you've raised a deep philosophical issue. And the idea that because there is no one who wants to come into existence, therefore it would be fine to cease bring them into existence, I think has other counterintuitive problems. And that's why this is a difficult problem, because any solution has something counterintuitive. Because, for example, it would give us an easy way of overcoming the climate change problem. We just all get sterilized. And then we can party up, we can use whatever dirty energy we like. It doesn't matter because, climate change is already around, it's not great, but we're going to die, and those future generations are not going to suffer from it. Well, is that okay? I mean, think about that intuitively. I don't like it, I must say. I think that there's something wrong with the idea that we would not bring beings into existence who may have a really rich and positive future. And you mentioned the long-termists in effective altruism. Some of the more optimistic ones, like Will McCaskill, think that we will eventually solve all the technological problems about feeding people, and we may colonize other planets, perhaps throughout the Milky Way galaxy, and there could be vast numbers of people all living rich and positive lives. But if it's a bad thing that that doesn't happen, that we do sterilize ourselves and party and go, then we have, the same could apply to the chickens, right? If the hens are living good lives, there's something positive about that. Now, whether it outweighs the fact that they're killed prematurely is another question. But I don't find it an easy issue to solve, and I've looked at a lot of the philosophical literature. It was really started in a deep way by Derek Parfit, who was an Oxford philosopher who was there when I was a graduate student and who I became a friend later on. Sadly, he died, I think, 6 years ago. And he didn't solve it, and he was, perhaps the closest to a genius that I've ever spoken to as a philosopher. And there are many other bright philosophers working on it and haven't solved it, so that's why I'm prepared to say in that interview and elsewhere, I can't definitively refute the idea that bringing chickens or other animals into existence is not a benefit for them that could justify ending their lives prematurely.
Thank you. And if anyone wants to get an ethical vasectomy and party hard out the front, I will be there afterwards.
Lawrence, just listen to your audio clip asking Peter Singer that question at the talk. What are your first impressions?
So I was basically asking him, it was within the context of, a chicken on a genuinely free range farm.
Yeah. A genuinely happy chicken living by chicken standards, a genuinely good life.
But obviously, there's the sort of underlying, there's the undertone there of, is it okay to create happy people as well, right? Which he picked up on, you know, straight away. He understood that there's a wider sort of population ethics style question there. Which
that was
the
first thing that I noticed, was he straight away picked up on the population ethics point.
Yeah.
About nobody asking to come into existence.
Exactly. And it runs along the lines of you know, Narveson's dictum that I was talking about before. Basically, you know, should we be making people happy or making happy people? So yeah, he picked up on that straight away, which was good. But my general, obviously he did say something, but I don't think he really said anything substantial. He more just said that there needs to be more sort of serious debate around this topic. And he doesn't have a strong opinion either way.
Yes.
But he errs on the side of it's good to make, to bring new sentient beings into existence if you know that they're going to have a good life by the standards of whatever species that is.
Yes. It's almost like he has to take that position to avoid taking the antinatalist pill.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what color that would be. Red. Yeah. Black. I don't know what color pill that would be, using the Matrix reference. But yeah, that's the position that he has to take. But he doesn't take it firmly, as you mentioned.
Exactly.
He's not really sure.
Yeah, because I mention it when I'm asking him the question that, you know, it's in the context of an interview that he had with Jamie Harris and Jamie Harris is someone different, but still EA related.
Yeah.
even in that interview or conversation, he does admit that this is a topic that he doesn't have, you know, he hasn't fully made up his mind. So I can appreciate the you know, the humble nature of that, you know.
Definitely.
But I'm not sure, I don't know, like, what are your thoughts? Because I'm not sure, because he didn't really take a strong position either way, I'm not really sure what there is to respond to.
Well, I think it's telling that one of the, again, the most prominent, and in my humble opinion, one of the best ethical philosophers of our time, who's really dedicated himself to the question of how can we make the world a better place, the fact that he doesn't have such a knockdown answer to antinatalism is really, really telling, because again, people, when you talk about antinatalism to, for want of a better term, normies, they act like this is some crazy position, that it's you know, it's completely out there, this kind of thing. And again, as we'll get to later in the series, some of the EAs, some of the effective altruist community, who are supposedly dedicated to making the world a better place, they don't have, they act like this is just a completely daft position. Whereas Peter Singer, the philosopher that the EA community and EA philosophy is mostly stems from, he doesn't have a knockdown position on it. He defers to Derek Parfit, who will come up in our long-termist episode later.
Yep.
But Derek Parfit is someone who really went to extreme measures to dedicate his life to moral philosophy. And he really asked himself that question of whether or not it's a good thing to create happy people. And he arrived at a rather uncertain yes, which we'll get to later in the long term as well. But again, Peter Singer doesn't truly endorse that position, because as you're saying, Lawrence, he says that he hasn't really solved that for himself. He's almost like relying on the authority of those like Will McCaskill and Derek Parfit, who he respects, both EA-related figures who take the position that it is a good thing to create happy lives. But I do think that there's an interesting point that wasn't really drawn upon, which I think it's implicit in Peter Singer's answer, but a lot of people don't intuitively have it. And that is, for those chickens that come into existence, people would say it would be wrong to bring them into existence and kill them prematurely so that you could eat their meat, for example. And Peter Singer says in his answer that, okay, it's something that we're, you know, putting that issue to one side. And as antinatalists, well, a lot of people would intuitively say, especially a lot of vegans would say, no, it's wrong to bring the chicken into existence or any being into existence if you're going to kill them prematurely. And an antinatalist might say, as certainly I do, that yes, it would be wrong to kill them prematurely, but if you bring them into existence at all, they're going to die. And that death will be a bad thing for them. That will be a harm, whether it's premature or not. Yeah. Whether you kill that chicken after 2 years or 6 weeks, as happens in the industrial meat industry, but we're talking specifically about a happy chicken. Let's say it's had 2 years of good life, or you leave it to live for 4 or 5 years and then it dies of natural causes. That death, when it happens, will be a harm. A harm that you have imposed upon them by bringing them into existence. So in many ways, it doesn't really matter to the question of whether or not it's a premature death or not. I mean, it does matter because one of them would be worse. I do think that, you know, killing the chicken after 2 years is worse than letting it expire naturally after four. But it's still a harm that you're imposing on them. That, as you said, that no being has asked to come into existence. No being has asked for that harm. And it's a being that you impose upon them by bringing them into existence.
Yeah.
And that's something that probably wasn't time to be fair. There probably wasn't time to get into that when you asked Peter Singer that question.
Yeah. No, I think like those are all good observations. And the other thing that I think often is sort of left aside in these questions of population ethics is like grounding it in reality.
Yes.
They get very hypothetical very quickly. And you start talking about these, you know, imagine if we could create, you know, individuals who have blissful lives, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, at the end of the day, that is somewhat interesting to talk about. But as you were saying before, like Peter Singer prides himself on this practical nature of ethics,
yes,
you know, really absolutely trying to get to grips with questions that the answers will have actual implications for the way we act. And talking about chickens who have happy lives, whilst it isn't nonsensical to talk about chickens that have happy lives, I think often when people are having that conversation, they are thinking about lives that are a lot better than the even the best chickens have, you know, in the world at the moment. Like these, when people imagine a chicken with a happy life, they usually think basically about a chicken that is on a free range farm.
Yeah. Or maybe even like a backyard chicken that just
pops around the garden. Yeah, a backyard chicken.
Yeah.
Exactly. But if we really want to bring that question into the real world and talk about it practically, we've got to realize that even if you do think it's good to bring happy chickens into existence, what is the nature? Like, can we even achieve that sort of level of happiness for a chicken? Because even if you, like, let's take the example of backyard chickens who they, you know, only the extra eggs are taken or whatever, you know, and in that way people can argue there's no harm done. Like, they are still going to suffer predation sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, there's no, unless you have chickens in Fort Knox, there's no way you're going to completely keep all of them safe, right?
As someone whose parents own backyard chickens, twice now a fox has got in and torn them to shreds.
Exactly, right. There's also the question of, like, these eggs are going to be laying eggs.
The chickens are going to be laying eggs.
Yeah, sorry, what did I say?
The eggs are going to be laying eggs.
Oh, right, okay. No,
you
the
got
eggs
the chicken
are
and the egg the wrong
eggs.
Way around. That old chestnut, that old
exactly,
philosophical problem.
It finally came round to slam dunk me. So yeah, the chickens are going to be laying eggs. All sorts of things can go wrong with that, like, you know, like in a human pregnancy. But I mean, I don't actually know the statistics, but I would imagine more things go wrong with a chicken just because they've been artificially bred at this point to produce so much, so many eggs.
Four or five eggs a week. Just following on from that, A typical chicken, egg-laying chicken, produces 4 or 5 eggs a week. When the distant, like wild ancestor of the chickens that we have now would have 1 egg every 28 days. So similar to like a human menstrual cycle. Yeah. They've now been bred for 4 or 5 eggs a week. And this leads to things like deficiencies in minerals. It can be painful for chickens. Sometimes the eggs get stuck. Very often a chicken will eat their eggs that they've laid to recycle the nutrients. It's a very, very common thing amongst egg-laying chickens. So there are a ton of problems. And yeah, if you're bringing these chickens into existence, half of them are going to be female, realistically, in the real world. And there's a very good chance they've been bred to have this artificially high number of eggs.
Yeah. But yeah, so like I don't need to detail all of the, you know, things. Like they're going to have to, yeah, that, you know, they'll generally be outside for harsh winters, all of this sort of stuff. You know, I don't need to detail every harm that a supposedly happy chicken is still going to go through in the real world.
Yeah.
I think people get the point. But yeah, I think that's just important to mention, because I think sometimes these philosophical discussions, they get too philosophical.
Definitely.
And they become unshackled from reality, or whatever the term is.
No, definitely. And there would be no meat industry could survive unless you set it up in like Silicon Valley, where everyone was super rich. The cost of rearing a chicken to have a happy life by Peter Singer's standard would be astronomical. You'd have to have it live a good life for a period of time. You'd have to treat it well. You couldn't cram them together. You'd have to ensure that they had like adequate space. You'd have to treat them for any diseases or infections that they might get. You'd have to slaughter them well in a genuinely humane way, not the way that chickens are slaughtered in slaughterhouses currently. Many of them are killed unstunned, boiled, unstunned. Sometimes they're not killed by the first cut to the neck. It's incredibly brutal, the industrial chicken industry. And that's got nothing to do with like sadism or people hating chickens or farmers or slaughterhouse workers wanting to cause the chickens harm. It's that the profit incentive means that to make chicken profitable, you have to treat them badly. You have to cram in as many as you can. You have to kill them very young. You have to breed chickens that grow so fast that their legs break from under the weight of them. This is what is done to turn a profit in the meat industry. And the chickens that Peter Singer is talking about would not be profitable unless you had an incredibly wealthy group of clients who'd be willing to pay an astronomical amount for a chicken breast. So again, very, as you're saying, very undetached from the real world and the reality of the lives of chickens in any kind of realistic scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I also think that point that you're saying about what life's like, that also applies to humans. So when he was talking about humans taking to the stars and colonizing the galaxy, it's not that I think that that is unrealistic. I mean, given enough time, enough technological development, like anything can happen. It would be a foolish errand for us to predict the future. But right now, the lives that human beings live are so far away from the kinds of utopian lives that people talk about in these thought experiments where every day is better than the last, where you wake up in the morning and think, wow, how can yesterday get even better than can today be even better than yesterday? And it is, and you're surprised, and you never get bored, you never get sick, you never get depressed. Like this is just so far away from the reality of people's experiences and also the reality of ways that people relate to happiness, the things that make people happy. Like there's usually some sort of balance of suffering that makes people happy. Like I'm not even sure if in the way that humans are kind of wired now, if you like, that a permanently blissful state is even possible. Like people get bored very quickly if they retire early with all their money. They start to feel unfulfilled in their lives. So it's a really tricky one to make happy people. And again, it just feels very unattached from reality to talk about these kind of extremely happy, blissful lives, which again, nobody asks to live.
Yeah.
Even if you did create those happy chickens and those happy, blissful lives, they didn't ask for it. And there's, from our perspective, absolutely no harm whatsoever for from not bringing these beings into existence, and there's a great deal of potential harm from doing that.
Yeah, the only final thing I would add as well is, like, even if we were to get to a point where we could provide chickens and humans and everyone with, you know, genuinely amazing lives, I still think there would be a reason not to be indifferent in a real world scenario, because in a philosophical, you know, if we were just talking in the abstract, if people and chickens genuinely had lives that would contain no bad, I would be indifferent. But in the real world, I would actually still be against it, because as soon as you bring beings into existence and the nature of existence is uncertain, no matter what structures you've put in place and what facilities you've put in place to facilitate these amazing lives, they can always degrade and go bad. You know, no utopia lasts forever.
Absolutely.
And so to me, it just seems like, you know, why, even if you can create people with amazing lives, you know that there's still some risk involved in that. So why would you run that risk in the first? I just don't get it. When the other alternative is simply not to create them in the first place, and they didn't even want to come into existence anyway, that it just seems like the safer option to me.
Absolutely. And this is the way that people's lives are, unfortunately. It's a lot easier for things to go really badly wrong. There are plenty of examples, both on an individual and even like a civilizational level, of where things have gone to shit really, really quickly. Mm. You see a lot of homeless people who were living a good life, and then through an addiction or through a traumatic event, whatever it might be, their lives just fall apart really quickly. And the same with civilizational collapse. Like, if you were living in ancient Rome 2000 years ago and admiring how technologically advanced, how superior you were, and then you have hundreds of years or even 1,000 years of the Dark Ages where you're less technologically advanced than you were in the past. And again, collapsing quite quickly by historical terms. It's so much easier for things to go wrong without intending it to than for things to go right. I really can't think of any examples, really, where someone's life through no deliberate effort has just suddenly gone right for them. Mm. Like, it's a very rare thing to do. I don't know, maybe you bump into the person down the street and you happen to fall in love. But that would usually take some deliberate effort towards it. Whereas we often see, through no deliberate effort of making the one's life worse, where the situation just gets bad for somebody very, very quickly. Mm. And yeah, that is a risk that you're taking by bringing sentient beings into existence. I can't think of a smooth segue into the second question. So we're just going to play the audio. So that was Lawrence. We just heard Lawrence's question there. We're now going to hear my question to Peter Singer from the same talk, which is about whether or not vegans should have children. Let's roll the audio.
You mentioned someone asked you about antinatalism in an interview because it's like a growing thing in the vegan community. The idea that it's a bad idea to bring sentient beings into existence. And you said that you were worried that if the people who care about animals stop breeding, then they won't be able to pass on those ethics to their children. And my question is, from an effective altruist perspective, should I spend roughly 250 grand to raise a kid and hope that I can kind of indoctrinate them with veganism? Or should I donate that money to spread the meme of veganism further? Which one do you think would be a better use?
I don't want you to indoctrinate your kids. I want you to educate your kids and hope that they understand, therefore, the truth about that lie behind veganism. So I think it's a serious question. You know, I mean, obviously you can save resources. I'm not sure, you know, how you cash out the cost of bringing up kids, but it is substantial. Eventually, they will no doubt earn something back. It may, you never know, look after you in your old age. I think it's a serious question. But I just do think people should think about, as a downside of doing what you're suggesting, not having children, but trying to spread this message. I think a downside is that we don't know what it is that leads people to be ethical, whether there's a genetic component into it or whether it's entirely environmental. But if it is environmental, I'm sure that parental influence and the home that you are reared in and the example your parents set and what you're used to eating is all relevant. So I am somewhat concerned about the fact that there seems to be this tendency, as you say, in the vegan community and in general, and people who think about the long-term future of our planet, that they're not going to reproduce. And not all of them are going to say, and if I don't reproduce, then I will use the money in the way that you suggested. Some of them may do that, but some of them are not going to do that, I know. Thank you.
So just heard the audio of my question to Peter Singer about whether or not vegans should have children. And Lawrence, what are your thoughts on the question and Peter Singer's response to it?
Well, I think it's a I think it's a good question, because I think there will be a lot of people out there that are not entirely convinced by antinatalist philosophy. You know, which from our perspective is unfortunate, but it's, you know, it's how the cookie crumbles, like whatever. Some people aren't going to be convinced by it. But I think even if someone isn't convinced by antinatalist philosophy in and of itself, there are additional sort of, I forget what the term is, but there's additional arguments that people that are sort of aligned with antinatalism that people can find convincing, right? And and one of them that's aimed towards effective altruists is this idea that having a biological kid and raising them, or even adopting as well, carries an opportunity cost. Now, having a biological kid carries a further opportunity cost, because obviously it has the, you know, you could have alternatively adopted someone. So, you know, you'd still be spending the resources on raising someone, but it, at least it would be someone who already exists. So I think it's good that, like, you asked this question, and this general notion exists that having a biological kid comes with these opportunity costs, because it will appeal to an audience that, you know, the other arguments may not. In terms of Peter Singer's response, so it's good that he recognizes that this is, you know, he doesn't just dismiss it, which I can see a lot of people doing. So it's good that he recognizes, you know, this is an important issue and people actually need to, you know, try and weigh up, you know, it's a serious question. Is investing, you know, 20 years or more of your life into raising one additional person, and all of the resources and emotional energy that goes into that, with all of the uncertainty that you may create someone who has a lasting disability and needs lifelong care, you may create someone who, you know, you have a very complicated relationship and that, you know, impacts you negatively. Like, there are many uncertainties, and it's very resource and time intensive. And this question just, like, highlights that and draws attention to the fact that you could take the road that doesn't, like, hold that risk, you know, and you still have all that time and those resources at your disposal to be able to put into other places that have been measured already that we know do effective good. So I think it's a good all round, like, question and argument. Going back to what Peter said, he also talks about how, you know, an argument for still having children, whilst it is very resource intensive, is that we don't entirely understand how moral change happens in the long term, and we don't know the extent that genetics plays.
I think just to tweak it slightly, it's not just about the moral change in terms of, like, a societal change. It's about what causes people to make moral decisions and to live by those moral decisions,
right?
And whether genetics plays a role in the extent to which people are that try and make ethical decisions in their life.
I think that's a valid thing to look into. Like, I think if we were able to get an answer to that question, that would be a good thing, because antinatalists would now be able to navigate the the path forward to making the world a better place with a more accurate understanding of how the world actually is.
Yes.
And the dynamics within it. Even though it, you know, there may be an answer to that question, which is more convenient to antinatalism, which would be that genetics doesn't really play that much of a role, because then we would have a greater case for not having, you know, not necessarily passing on your genes, but, you know, doing work elsewhere. I think it's still good to get an answer, even if it isn't one that's convenient to us, because we'll have a more accurate view of reality that we can use to move forward. And the final thing I'd say is that he also expresses concern about people who are ethically minded not having children. I don't know if it would be people who are ethically minded, maybe people who have the veneer of being ethically minded, but he expresses concern that people won't have children and won't use the resources that they would have used to raise the child on, you know, other ways of doing good. They might just, trying to use like a sanitized version here, but they might waste it all, you know?
Yes.
So,
which price compared to what we could have said. they get a nice fancy car and they go on some nice holidays and they get a nice spray tan or whatever the hell they're going to spend their money on.
Yeah.
Comparatively frivolously compared to donating it to charity.
Yeah. And I think that is a concern. But I think if someone was going to do that, then it's not clear to me that they would be the best people to raise kids anyway, because they don't seem like they would actually be that ethically minded. But anyway, yeah, those are my thoughts. What did you think?
So obviously I thought the question was fantastic. I tell you what, I did feel a bit nervous going up there. I'm normally pretty decent at public speaking, but I did think, oh shit, it's Peter Singer.
Yeah.
I admire you so much. So I was really, I was just thrilled, first of all, to be able to get a question out in the Q&A. Definitely a highlight of my year this year, for sure. In terms of Peter Singer's answer, I think I agree with every word, to be honest. Every single word that he said. This might be my spiciest antinatalist take. First of all, I agree with what you said, Lawrence. Like, if your goal in life is to have a positive impact on the world, then I truly believe that having children is a really, really, really big mistake. In terms of the money, 250K, but even more than that, arguably, the emotional effort that you put into it, the fact that you can't take a gamble with your career to have an impactful career that adds benefits to, because you have to think about providing for your family. The fact that your kid might not agree with you in the slightest about your ethical concerns. A lot of people are what I call it like delayed good or delayed philanthropy, where a lot of parents say, my kid is going to do a lot of good in the world. And I'm always tempted to ask, well, did you do a lot of good in the world? Because why do you expect your kid to? It's like, you should do the good yourself rather than bringing in a kid and then putting all these expectations on them.
It's like outsourcing altruism.
Yeah, exactly. Then you get to take credit for it because, you know, your genitals were used to produce this child that went on to have all this positive impact when you could be trying to have the positive impact yourself. And just to make it clear, by the way, I am not having anywhere, even though, you know, vegan, AA, giving what we can pledge, donating this charity. People don't say, when they think about the positive impact their kid's going to have on the world, they tend to go way beyond that. They tend to be like, oh no, my kid's going to cure cancer, or my kid's going to do this amazing thing that's like really out there. And I'm like, well, you know, you didn't do that amazing thing. And so far, I'm not doing that amazing thing either. So it seems like a really big expectation to put on your kid.
Yeah.
So yeah, genuinely, if you are trying to make the world better and having an impact focus, just for the burden, the financial, emotional, the constraints it puts on your life, don't have a kid. Just don't do it if impact is your focus. Now, the thing I agree with Peter Singer on, and this is maybe my based hot take on antinatalist, and that is, if they're not going to have an impact focus, so you've got a vegan person who's, again, for want of a better term, a vegan normie out there, just wants to live a standard life. They're not going to have this impact focus.
Mm.
would it be a better idea for them to have children, or would it be a better idea for them to just spend the money on holidays, meals out, getting a nice break, whatever the hell they want to spend it on, fancy cars, whatever. And genuinely, I think there is a case to say that having children for them in the current context might be the better course of action. Now, as an antenatal,
in terms of what? In terms of impact?
In terms of impact, yes. In terms of the world that we live in now. Genuinely, like, as an antenatalist, I don't think it's a good idea to bring any sentient beings into existence, obviously. But I do recognize that there will be people in the future. Like, right now, there are lots of people breeding in the world. There will be people in the future. And I want some of those people to be vegan. As Peter Singer said, we don't really know what it is that causes people to be ethical, but if it is nature or nurture, having kids, like the influence that a parent has on their kids is quite substantial in terms of both nature, obviously genetics, and nurture in terms of how they're raised. And if you're not going to go out there and try and have an impact as a vegan on the world, you're just going to be vegan and have no positive impact on the world, then there's a very good chance you'll actually do less good in the world than if you had a kid who was vegan. Now, that said, just a ton of caveats on this. This would only be for ethically strap vegan for the next, parents.
Strap in for the next half an hour of caveats.
Yeah, huge on caveats for this. So in this scenario, you'd have an ethically vegan parent who's with an ethically vegan partner, first of all. Yeah. Let's say that they've screened themselves for hereditary conditions as well. So there's a decent chance that their kid will be healthy by today's standards. And while they're not going to like indoctrinate their kid and like whip them in it, they are planning on raising their kids vegan, which why again by no means guarantee that kid will be vegan. There's a higher likelihood that kid will be vegan than the kids down the road that don't have vegan parents. I think in that situation, that might be, if not a good thing to do, it might be the least bad thing to do compared to a vegan that tries to have no impact in the world and squanders all their money on themselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I think in terms of impact, when you get to the point when you're talking about people who aren't, because like when you're having, if you kind of remove antenatalist ethics and talk about, you know, how can someone in terms of procreation have an impact in the world, you know, to make it a better place, specifically in regards to animals. It's easier to have a conversation when you're talking about people who are impact driven, because you can talk about alternative behaviors that they can be engaging in or activities they can be engaging in apart from procreation. But with this example, they wouldn't be. Now, I actually don't think many people would fall into this category. I think most vegans, if you had an honest conversation with them, would agree that being impact focused is the correct thing to do.
I think though, Lawrence, though, to be fair, we are talking about like there's a very small proportion of the population that's vegan, but in our, you know, in our circle, in our social lives, we are, you know, speaking with vegan activists who tend to be quite logical and will say yes, I do see that taking the impact approach is probably the best one. But I'm talking vegan normies. I'm talking
standard
people. They want the standard life plan. They want to grow old and die, having raised a family with a white picket fence, and you know, bought a house, and they go on a holiday every couple of years, whatever like the standard life plan is with their family.
Yeah.
I think there's an argument that that might be the better option compared to a vegan who just lives frivolously and tries to have no impact on the world.
Yeah, if we're just talking about impact, I honestly don't know. So yeah. I'd be open to conceding that, but I think it's, to me, it's just like these things are so hard to predict.
Yeah.
Because you've got to weigh up the two, because to me, the possible different outcomes are asymmetric. So even though it's, let's say for the sake of argument, you know, an ethical vegan family who, you know, they don't you know, they're kind of, you know, they're like the picture you painted, the normie vegans, but they're ethically vegan. If they're raising a kid, let's say for the sake of argument, it's more likely the kid will be vegan than not be.
Yes. Or not even not be. It's more likely they'll be vegan compared to the non-vegan kid down the road with his non-vegan parents.
Yeah. But even with that in mind, it seems to me that there's an asymmetrical nature to the possible consequences of still bringing them into existence, because even if there's a small chance that they are non-vegan, the amount of animals they're going to be killing as a non-vegan is going to be quite large, like in the thousands.
Yes.
And we don't really have a clear idea. Like that stuff we kind of know, because we kind of know the impact of the average person in terms of the resources they consume and stuff. Yes. But we don't know how much the average vegan would contribute to ethical change, especially if they're not actively advocating for it. So to me, there's some asymmetry there in terms of we don't know if the impact would be good or bad, but it seems like if the impact is bad, the magnitude of it could be greater than, or we know that the magnitude of the bad consequences will be quite bad in terms of the number of animals, but we don't know what the magnitude of the good could be. It's still like very uncertain. So I'm like hesitant on it, but I understand where you're coming from.
That's true. And the possible risk is extremely high. I want to make that point clear as well. So your typical Westerner, and I'll take a couple of steps back. It's hard to say how much moral value that a human being has compared to a chicken or a cow or a pig or a tuna fish, whatever it might be. And even if you think it's 1,000 to 1, you think that the harm done by, let's say, stabbing to death a chicken, a cow, pig, fish, whatever it might be, is 1,000 to 1. A typical Westerner eats several thousand animals over the course of their lives.
Yeah.
So this would be the equivalent harm of torturing and killing several people. And at that rate, you're in serial killer numbers. There's a very famous serial killer here in the UK in Victorian times, everyone knows, called Jack the Ripper. Jack the Ripper killed several people. And if you're having a kid, if there is a chance that you're having a kid in the West, there's a very good chance that they will do the the standard normie behavior in the West, which unfortunately is to kill several thousand animals. And that's a big chance that you're a risk that you're having as vegan parents. And that's why I put a ton of caveats on it to put the chance as high as possible. At this point, I really just don't know. This is not something that I advocate for. Like I said, I still think it would be wrong to have kids as a vegan parent. I just think it might be less wrong. There's a possibility that it's less wrong than just being a parent that a vegan that has no impact. And I do think that this has some practical considerations for us, Lawrence, because while that we are antinatalist advocates who encourage people not to have children, I think it means that we probably shouldn't, of all the communities for us to target to not have children, I don't think that we should be targeting vegans.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, because if you think about all the individual, like if we just focus on humans right now, all the individuals being brought into existence, they aren't going to all, and we ignore the harm that's being caused to them, right, by their coming into existence. But we think about the harm they're causing to others or the benefits they may bestow upon others, right? That it's not equal, you know, there's great disparity there.
Yeah.
Some groups and individuals will cause a lot more harm and a lot less good, or a lot more good and a lot less harm.
Yes.
And my feeling is that, and I feel like this is a, you know, a relatively sort of well-founded feeling, is that ethical vegans, especially those who advocate for such a position and do active work to make the world better, they are going to be amongst the groups that do the most good and probably the least harm as well. I think especially in a modern society with a global supply chain, it's kind of hard to measure how much harm someone does. But relative to someone else in the exact same conditions who isn't an ethical vegan advocating for animals, they're obviously doing less harm.
Yeah. It's interesting that you view it that way around, that they're possibly doing more good and less harm, because I view it the other way. I think that they are probably doing less harm. I'm not sure if they're doing any additional good, if that makes sense. It's the additional good I'm not sure about. I think your typical vegan, even the vegan that I'm talking about, who, again, spends all their money on frivolous stuff, they're probably doing significantly less harm.
It's like when you're picking who to focus your energy on advocating antinatalism to, if that's what you're going to be doing, pick the ones that are causing the most harm first.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Which is okay, Westerners, I get what you mean. Non-vegan Westerners, as far as I can tell. And that's the thing which, and the reason I was thinking about this was actually after the Peter Singer, after we saw Peter Singer talk, I saw an article in the Daily Mail that says vegans and veggies don't have children, says philosopher. That was something like that. And it was a philosopher who said, as we have said here, that there are links between veganism and antinatalism, and for the same reasons that, you know, you don't want to bring suffering into the world, you should consider not having children.
Yeah.
But the way it was presented in the Daily Mail headline said that vegans and veggies being vegetarians in particular, should not have children. And I'm there thinking, well, no, I don't think anyone should have children, but especially if you're going to bring up your kids and if you increase the likelihood of your kids paying for animal agriculture, you shouldn't have kids. So I think that we as antinatalist advocates, although it might be easier to win vegans over to team antinatalist because there are those connections, I don't think that we should be targeting our outreach and our advocacy towards vegans when there are so many others who are going to be breeding and again having a higher likelihood of their children causing all this suffering. And that was the thing that, to tie it back to Peter Singer's answer to the question, when he says right at the end, there are many people who won't have children and they're not going to use the money in the way that you suggest. In other words, the money that they save from having kids, the resources, the time, the energy that they save from having kids, they're not going to put it towards donating to charity or just in general trying to make the world a better place in an impact focused way. I thought, you're absolutely right. And that is more motivation for me. I now need to walk the walk and make sure that the money and time and effort that I do save from having children, that it does actually go towards making the world better and that I don't become one of those vegans who just fritters my money away. You know, maybe getting a nice hair transplant or whatever it might be. 30K down the drain. Do you have any other thoughts, Lawrence, on Peter Singer's answer to the question?
No, I don't think so. But the only thing I would say, the only other additional thing I would say about Peter Singer generally in antinatalism is just that if the people listening ever get opportunities to go to an event that he is at and ask questions, definitely take it up and ask him a question about antinatalism, because I think the more people talking about antinatalism, the better, especially people who have thought about ethics a lot. And the more people who ask him about this topic, the more likely he is to maybe, you know, write or think about it seriously. So, and getting, you know, arguably the world's most influential philosopher to talk about this subject, even if it's one he's not necessarily agreeing with, he's just unsure about, it's still a good way to get the ball rolling on conversations.
Absolutely.
And people, you know, if he puts something out, people respond to it and et cetera, et cetera. So if you do get the opportunity, I would just advise people to or encourage people to take it and ask him a question.
Absolutely. Antinatalism at its core is an ethical philosophy, and Peter Singer is the most prominent, or a moral philosophy. There are distinctions between ethical and moral that I always forget and use them interchangeably, but you know, it is a moral philosophy, and Peter Singer is arguably the most prominent moral philosopher alive today, and maybe even of all time, given the many cause areas that he's been involved in over the years. So having him talk about antinatalism through your questions, you know, it really does carry weight, just to echo Lawrence's points. So yeah, Lawrence, obviously you're going to be back on the podcast a ton in the future.
Yeah.
It's not one and done, I'm afraid. I mean, you're contractually obligated to come on. So we won't do this kind of wrap up after every episode. But yeah, if there's anything that you're working on or any ways that people can get in touch or follow you if you'd like them to, anything like that you'd like to share now?
Yeah, well, if people want to get in contact with me, they can find me on Twitter. If you just type in Lawrence Anton, I should come up. I think the Twitter, X as it's called now,
yes,
handle
X. I keep forgetting that too, X.
Yeah, is Lawrence Anton 1. But I'm sure, you know, John can include a link on any of the descriptions.
Definitely,
where this is posted.
Be included.
Yep. And if you'd like to email me as well, it's just lawrenceant@protonmail.com. Apart from that, anything I'm working on, a bunch of stuff for the YouTube channel, just a bunch of recordings scheduled in. I'm going for a hike. Well, I'll have already been for it by the time this comes out. But once I get back from that, I got a bunch of scheduled recordings, which I'm really looking forward to. And I've got a bunch of videos that that I've got, you know, in the pipe works. Other than that, working on the conference in the background. So anyone who's excited about that, definitely sign up to our newsletter.
Yeah.
I think that's everything.
Definitely. And by the time this podcast episode comes out, it will be, because it's early September here now, so there'll be a month and a half down the line, a month and a half closer to the conference. So you'll be hearing a lot more about it. You will be hearing a lot more about it down the line. Something I always like to end the episodes on is something positive that is antinatalism related that you'd like to share. Because again, as I always say in every episode, antinatalism does have an at times deserved reputation for being quite a down and depressing and negative philosophy and frankly community. So I do like to end these podcasts on a positive or potentially uplifting note. So what comes to your mind, Lawrence, when I ask you this?
Well, I would just say it seems like the energy in the community is building, which is very exciting. More people are being productive, getting out there, building things, growing things, which I think is really good. I think, you know, whilst it is good in and of itself to have a community, it's even better if that community is doing productive work to try and make the world a better place. And there are a range of people doing a range of projects now, of a various different types, and they are all really exciting. And there's more things that I'm aware of that are in the pipeline that people are doing. So I think whilst the community is still small, and our capacity for doing stuff is still relatively small, we're setting up good foundations and a good, we're building good momentum to, I think, really have a positive future, which I'm happy about, because I haven't been in the antinatalist community for the longest by any means, but whilst I've been in the community, it has been relatively stagnant, and from what I hear from people who have been in the community longer than me, that is, it has been stagnant for quite a while. So it's really good to see some energy in the community and people building things. Cause I think it's very easy to sit in the comfort and the safety of a Facebook group or a Discord channel, or to be a cynic about things. But it's harder to build things. And I think it's really good that people are trying to build things. I'm optimistic about the future of the antinatalist community, hopefully not naively so, but we will see.
Yeah, me too. I think again there's an element of like perception being reality, and how my perception, because we are slowly building momentum here at Antinatalist Advocacy, that I am starting to see more stuff pop up as well, and that I do feel a bit more of a positive note in the antinatalist advocacy space. And I don't just mean antinatalist advocacy as in our organization, but just general those who are trying to get out there and have that positive impact on the world. One thing I, and so, probably my favorite, oh, I mean, there are, again, not just saying this, there are genuinely so many good videos on your channel, and I will be linking them in the description here. One of my all-time favorites is the interview you did with the antinatalist from Somalia.
Oh, right. Yeah,
it's half an hour long, and I just found it so inspiring. I mean, this individual, the bravery that they have. Yeah, I'll be sharing that for sure in the description of this episode. If you want to be inspired by someone who is bravely going against a ton of social pressure. I don't mean social pressure in terms of people calling you names. I mean social pressure in terms of you could literally be killed for being honest about your beliefs. Someone who is showing a ton of bravery in living as an antinatalist in a culture like that, then check out Lawrence's episode about antinatalism in Somalia, which will of course be linked below. But yeah, thanks again for coming on, Lawrence. You'll be back on again soon for another episode responding to effective altruism on antinatalism. But yeah, thanks again, and thank you to you for listening. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. We would also be really grateful if you could help us get the word out there by sharing this episode far and wide, as well as giving us a positive rating on whichever platform you're listening to us on. To find out more about AA, including careers advice, donation recommendations, and different ways to have a positive impact, you can go to our website at antinatalistadvocacy.org. To keep up to date with what we're up to, feel free to subscribe to our monthly newsletter and follow us on your favourite social media platforms. Links to all of the above are in the description. As always, we are hoping you will join us in our antinatalist advocacy.